Welcome. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It's Friday, which means it's our weekly media roundtable where we talk about major stories of the week and how they were covered with journalists and you. Big story this week was that yesterday, President Obama formally released his proposal to overhaul the National Security Agency's bulk collection of telephone data. Now, the draft legislation that the president came out with aims to address concerns about privacy by replacing the NSA's current dragnet with a more limited program that would have phone companies keep the metadata and require the approval of the secret Federal Intelligence Security Court for specific requests related to national security. Edward Snowden, the whistleblower whose revelations brought the indiscriminate collection of personal information to light, called the proposal a turning point, but said it doesn't go far enough. So, how significant is this proposal, and who are the journalists who've done the best job unpacking its implications? Trevor Tim has some ideas. He is the executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation and specializes in free speech and government transparency. His work has appeared in The Atlantic, The Guardian, Politico, and other publications, and he joins us from his office in San Francisco. Hi, Trevor. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And it's also been a week of significant developments in Egypt. 529 members of the Muslim Brotherhood were condemned to death after a mass trial that lasted just 45 minutes. Also, Field Marshal Abdul Fattah al-Sisi, who led last summer's coup against President Mohamed Morsi, has announced he's going to quit the army so he can run for president himself. And at the same time, 20 Al Jazeera journalists were denied bail in their trial on charges of aiding terrorists and damaging Egypt's international reputation. So we wanted to know what it is like to be a journalist in Egypt right now, and Nancy Youssef knows about it. She covers the Middle East for the McClatchy newspaper chain, and she is based in Cairo, where she joins us from now. Good to have you back on the program, Nancy.
Great to be back.
Good to have you. And also with us for the Media Roundtable is Dave Leventhal. He is senior political reporter at the Center for Political Integrity, and he's just come out with an extensive report on the Koch brothers' role in funding academic programs at more than 150 U.S. universities. We will learn about what the Koch brothers are funding and talk about the role that they are playing in a year where Democrats want to make them the symbol of big money and right-wing politics. So, Dave, good to have you on the program. Welcome.
It's good to be back with you. Thank you.
All right. So we always start on Friday with positivities, kudos, not necessarily good news, but news that was reported well by a journalist, a good analysis, a newspaper or another outlet that's done really good work this week. So, Nancy, I want to start with you from Cairo. Talk about a piece of reporting you saw this week that impressed you.
Well, as you mentioned, we had an extraordinary verdict this week in Egypt, the conviction of 525 Islamists for the killing of one police officer. And Nathan Brown, who is a legal analyst on Egypt, wrote a very interesting piece for the Washington Post, really breaking down Egypt's legal system and how such a thing could happen. That it's not only about the politics, but the quirkiness, if you will, of the Egyptian legal system, the independence with which it operates, and the sometimes capricious nature of the judges who are in it. And he really explains in a very smart way, in a way that readers who have no familiarity with Egypt's justice system, why this happened and why it will likely be appealed. So I thought that was a great thing for readers to get a breakdown like that of such a opaque system that has become so critical to Egypt's future.
Nancy, if we could just take a moment to talk about that trial and the verdict that came out this week. I guess that, you know, many people hearing the headlines about this here might not recognize this. These are more than 500 people from a single town in Egypt, right?
That's right. So they are from Minya, which sits right in the middle of Egypt, along the Nile. It's actually where my family's from. And it has the highest concentration of Christians of any province in Egypt, 50% Christian. And these 529 were charged at the height of the violence that broke out after Mohamed Morsi was ousted from power, when a lot of Islamists were blaming Christians for Morsi's ouster, saying that they didn't support him and he was the reason that he was not allowed to finish his term. And so there were these churches that were being attacked, police stations that were being attacked, and these 529 were charged in that for the killing of one police officer, the attempted killing of two other people, and burning a series of churches. And so on Saturday, they had their first hearing, and the judge began the hearing, as all hearings begin here, with the listing of the names and figuring out who was in the courtroom. As you can imagine, 529 were not, and who were in absentia. He got into a fight with the lawyers and declared that he was going to give a verdict on Monday. So no evidence was heard, nothing. And on Monday, he announced all 529 had been sentenced to death. And it shocked the international community. For a lot of Egyptians, it was a welcome continuation of the crackdown on Islamists. But it was clear that the Egyptian government was quite embarrassed about it because of the clear injustice that had been carried out.
So there's going to be some other trials along these lines that are coming through, and this verdict itself may be appealed. But so you're saying there's kind of a disconnect between what happens at the local level and what the national government of Egypt might want to happen.
In this case, there was, and there isn't always, and that's what makes the justice system here so complex, because what nobody can really answer in any clear way is how independent the judiciary is from the government. In some ways, they are completely independent, but on the other hand, they actually understand what it is their government is after and the sort of message that they're trying to send. This judge, Yusuf Sabri, had a history of sort of making very bizarre verdicts. He sentenced one person to 15 years in prison for stealing an article of clothing. He sentenced another to 30 years for having some sort of argument with someone. So he was known for this. So I think in this case, it was an instance of a rogue judge. But I think by and large, there is an argument that the judiciary understands where it is their government expects them to take verdicts.
Well, Nancy Yusuf, reporting from Cairo, we will post that piece by Nathan Brown in the Washington Post on our website, yourcallradio.org. I want to get our other guests involved talking about reporting they were impressed with this week. Trevor Tim, let's come to you at the Freedom of the Press Foundation. What was a piece of reporting that you thought was valuable this week?
Well, there was a piece on Forbes Online by the reporter Annie Greenberg, which I thought was just really beautiful piece of reporting. It actually dealt with Bitcoin, the what's known as cryptocurrency, which has been the subject of a lot of headlines in the past few weeks. There is much controversy over Bitcoin, partly because the founder, the person who created the protocol, has been anonymous for years. And in the search for this person named Satoshi Nakamoto, Newsweek had published a cover story 2 weeks ago, supposedly outing the man that they thought was the founder. And many people think that actually they outed the wrong man. And Andy Greenberg, following a lead that he received from an anonymous source, ended up at the home of a man named Hal Finney. And Hal Finney is paralyzed by ALS. And Andy showed up at his house thinking that he was the actual founder of Bitcoin. But while he ended up realizing that this man was not actually the founder of Bitcoin, what happened was he really discovered that Hal Finney was at the forefront of all sorts of important research and projects that have really affected the foundation of the Internet for the past 20 years. All sorts of anonymous and privacy technology Hal Finney was central to, including what's known as PGP encryption, which is the most widely used encryption program on the Internet today. And I just think the piece that Andy wrote was really beautiful and touching, and the profile of Hal Finney, whose name many people don't know, I think it really showed how wonderful his contributions to technology and the Internet have been over the past 20 years, and in a sense, with a eulogy to the man that can actually barely speak at this point.
So in the Forbes piece is described as Satoshi Nakamoto's neighbor. Is it just a random coincidence that he happens to be next door to him?
Yes, this was probably one of the most amazing coincidences that's ever happened. You know, there was a big media frenzy over Satoshi Nakamoto 2 weeks ago, where reporters were literally chasing him down the streets of Los Angeles. Many people believe that he's in fact not the real Satoshi Nakamoto, but the second person to ever use Bitcoin was Hal Finney. And Hal Finney happens to live just a few blocks away from Dorian Nakamoto.
They didn't have to meet at an internet cafe. They could just go to each other's house.
Right. And so that is actually what led Andy to Hal Finney's home. But as you'll read through the story, it becomes clear that Hal Finney, while he worked directly with the real Satoshi Nakamoto and helped him through a lot of the processes early on, he's not actually, in fact, Satoshi Nakamoto himself. But the story Andy uncovers along the way is just as if intriguing, if not more so.
Well, we will definitely post a link to that, Andy Greenberg's piece on, in Forbes about this neighbor of Satoshi Nakamoto, Hal Finney, at yourcallradio.org. And finally, let's turn over to Dave Leventhal and get your kudos for the week.
Well, I grew up in Buffalo, New York, my beloved hometown, so it was with rapt interest that I read a piece about, strangely enough, professional bowling, because my father and my grandfather had participated in church leagues and auto factory leagues all throughout their lives. My father still does. And this piece by Zachary Crockett, who's actually a San Francisco-based writer, is all about the waxing and the waning of professional bowling, but also the money and the politics and the crime, the high hopes and the dreams dashed, all about what was once a major portion of Americana, but has fallen on very, very difficult times as of late. A great read. You don't have to be a sports fan to get a whole lot out of this piece, and you certainly don't have to be a bowling fan either. A great read for anyone who just cares about all those issues I just mentioned.
So bowling, Bitcoin, and the Egyptian justice system. We'll post all those stories recommended by our guests on yourcallradio.org. And I definitely want to invite listeners, if you have read or heard or seen a piece of reporting or analysis this week that really grabbed you, that you thought was important, that people should know about, please share it with us. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or call us 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or if you just want to go to yourcallradio.org, you can post a link yourself. That's where we're posting all the stories recommended by our guests. Nancy Youssef, you're in Cairo. We know it's late in the evening there, so I want to come to you to talk about other developments this week in addition to this trial of the Muslim Brotherhood members. Wanted to talk for a minute about the decision by Field Marshal al-Sisi to run for president. Now, I guess that when you are involved in the overthrow of an elected government, and then the idea that, later you might decide, I'd like to be the head of this government on an elected basis. I think from the outside, that may not seem so surprising. Is it surprising in Egypt that he made that move?
Yes and no. When he had overthrown Sisi in July, he had said he wouldn't run for president. And then he became the most popular Paul in Egypt. His picture was everywhere. They were putting out chocolates at bakeries with his picture on it. Women were fawning over him. He became a celebrity. And the momentum was such that it became all but inevitable that he would run, that there was essentially no other candidate. So at one point it was surprising, and then it became inevitable. And so when he finally did announce this week, after weeks of anticipation, he gave a very beautiful speech, a very impassioned speech, in which the themes that he hit on more than anything was his love of Egypt and this message of national unity, which has been so desperately needed at a time of deep polarization.
But it's also a time of intense repression, right?
Yeah, and that's a great point, in that his speech was very nationalistic and one that was an outreach to the Muslim Brotherhood, to Egyptians of all backgrounds. But he has been a part of the last 7 months in which we've seen the most aggressive crackdown in recent history. The conservative number is 16,000 people arrested since July, thousands of people killed, and a very, very divided politic. And so how much that rhetoric will actually translate into a new direction for Egypt remains unclear. I do think that there's an effort in this country to get past this crackdown period, to try to move the country forward, and that the elections will be the mark of, in which they'd like to sort of reset ground. And I think Sisi's speech, the tone of it, was an effort to start that process. One of the reasons you're seeing these trials of 529, we have another one coming up with 638 and another one of 919, I think is an effort to get things off the plate, if you will, in anticipation of a Sisi presidency. So you have all the institutions of government essentially working and campaigning on his behalf.
So, but in your report for McClatchy about his decision to run, his announcement that he would do this, you talked about people kind of being a sense of fatigue in the population, and the idea that, you know, maybe he's the person who can kind of run things and make Egypt stable. But I mean, who, when it comes to this, these elections, who actually will be able to participate, at least as a candidate?
Yeah, one of the things that was surprising, we've been hearing Sisi's name here literally for months and months and months, and yet when he made the announcement, it was almost a deafening silence in the population. We'd ride the subways and people weren't really talking about it. You'd go to offices and there wasn't a lot of chatter about it. And as we started to ask people, there was a sense of, we're thrilled that Sisi's running, but at the same time, we're scared. That is, we love the military, which is Egypt's most powerful institution, and we fear it at the same time. Because this institution and a Sisi presidency is not like a Morsi one. There's not going to be the mass movement that can sort of undo it in the way that it happened to Morsi. And even in the case of Mubarak, that took 3 decades. And I think there's a fear from some that Egypt is going back to the very system that they rose up against in 2011 and will confront the same challenges of overthrowing it, if not bigger ones, because the government has learned from the past 3 years. And so it was a very interesting mix of feelings. As to who can vote, everybody can, but you know, we talked to one person who said, I'm so sick of elections. There's been about
a Muslim Brotherhood leader can't run for president.
Oh, of course not. Well, they certainly can't run because it's a banned group. It's considered a terrorist organization. Anybody who's been arrested. I'm sorry, I thought you were asking who could vote.
Who could vote, but no, yeah.
Who can run, in terms of who can run, the liberals and some of those who haven't been caught up in this crackdown can run. The problem is, there's nobody else who has the kind of base of support. It is all but certain that Sisi will win. It is inconceivable that anyone else would be able to undo or beat the system that he's got the state behind him. So Hamdine Sabahi, who's a liberal candidate, is the only other person who's announced. Abdelmenem has said that he won't run. He was a former Brotherhood leader who became a sort of more moderate candidate. I think there's an understanding that this election, where Morsi's election was suspenseful, this one is a foregone conclusion, and Sisi will be the president.
So as a reporter, and I'm thinking in this a context where there is such intense repression, and not just against the Muslim Brotherhood, but other dissenting groups, when you go talk to people on the street and you want to ask them, hey, what do you think of Field Marshal Sisi, do you feel like you can really get an honest answer?
Well, people are afraid to talk, so we have to be a little bit creative. So to do the story you were referring to, we literally rode the subway and just listened to people, just rode the subway, because you can't sort of go to people cold and have them talk about it. And then we just sort of strike up conversations. And then we went to a middle-class or lower-middle-class neighborhood where we had we'd bought things just for ourselves, like peanuts and sweets and things, so that they would know who we were, and sat in the shop and listened to people and talked to their customers as they came in to create a sense of ease. But just going up and talking to people cold is not an option, not only because people aren't necessarily going to open, but there's a very suspicious sort of feeling among everyone here, so that you would immediately get sort of a defensive posture from people if you try to do it. So that's how we went about reporting that story.
You're listening to the Your Call Media Roundtable. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is the time of the week when we speak with journalists about major stories and get their input on how they were covered. Just speaking with Nancy Youssef. She covers the Middle East for the McClatchy newspaper chain, is based in Cairo. Also with us for the hour are Trevor Tim. He's the executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. We're going to be talking with him about the new plan the proposal for new legislation about NSA surveillance, specifically to do with telephone data, from the Obama administration. And we're going to be talking with Dave Leventhal, who joins us from Washington. He's a senior political reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. He's done a major investigation about the Koch brothers' role in funding American universities. So those are coming up. Dave and Trevor, we have just a little more time with Nancy before we say goodbye to her in Cairo. I'm going to come right back to you. If you all have any questions for her before she goes, I definitely want to get them. But I want to ask Nancy this week also, I mean, as a journalist watching this trial, or I should say the charges against the jailed Al Jazeera journalists, and they've been denied bail this week. Just talk about, I know you're one of the few journalists who actually got to talk to one of those journalists soon after they were jailed. What is it like for international journalists working in Egypt right now, and not to mention if you're an Egyptian journalist?
Well, on a personal level, it's very hard to see your friends and colleagues sitting in a cage because in the Egyptian judicial system, when you are a defendant, you are literally put in a cage during the proceeding. And I've been to, this is the third hearing for the three Al Jazeera correspondents who have been jailed in this case, and it never gets easier to see them in that position. They are charged with being running a terror cell out of their offices at the Marriott Hotel and consorting with the Muslim Brotherhood. The case of, against them, they're also charged with falsifying news, and it's clear in watching the proceedings that it's not going to go in their favor given the political climate. And so that's very disheartening. For me as a dual national, it's also very frightening because the protections that are afforded to Americans are not necessarily given to me because in this system I am treated as an Egyptian and not an American. And that's some of the things that, you know, Mohammed Fahmy, who's one of the three, is a dual national as well. And you can see the difference in treatment for him, particularly early on, than it was for Peter Grest, who's an Australian. So it's all very jarring. And I think for journalists here at House, all of us, and sort of a heightened awareness about who we talk to, who we give voice to, because you never know at what point the system could come after you. And if it does, the protections that were once afforded to Americans are no longer here because the government has changed and they're trying to move towards away from this sort of treating foreigners exceptionally. It's no longer like that. And so I think all of us are on a sense of, or have a sense of heightened awareness about the work we do and how we conduct it since this trial.
Dave or Trevor, any questions for Nancy before we say goodbye to her?
This is Dave, Nancy. I do have one question. With all of the activity overseas, at least as far as the United States is largely concerned, in the U.S. media is being focused on either Crimea, Ukraine, Malaysia, perhaps to a lesser degree Syria. Do you feel like the developments in Egypt are at all being lost on the American populace because of just the cacophony of other events happening elsewhere in the world?
You know, it's a great question, Dave. I can tell that Egypt is not nearly as fascinating to people as it was when I got here 2 years ago. I get the sense that people are exhausted from Egypt because it's been such a traumatic 2 years. But I do think that all these things are related. Certainly the events here and in Egypt and in Ukraine, because it's for us overseas, it feels like we are living in a transitional period in terms of international relations and how countries relate one another and the evolution of politics that the region has been completely changed in the last decade. U.S. relations here have been changed in the last 4 years. A lot of the same sort of elements you're seeing in the Ukraine, economic depression sort of leading to political upheaval, really. And so to me, it's all related, but I know to a lot of readers it isn't. But I'm kind of blissfully ignorant of it. I'm so consumed by Egypt all the time and what happens here that I really enjoy sort of following it because I think what happens here is a microcosm for the bigger changes that we're seeing around the world.
Well, Nancy, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program. Nancy Youssef covers the Middle East and for McClatchy Newspaper. She's based in Cairo, Egypt. You can read her reporting online. We've got links at yourcallradio.org. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar here on the Your Call Media Roundtable. Rose will be back on Monday. Also with us is Dave Leventhal. You were just hearing from him. He's a senior political reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. And also Trevor Tim, co-founder and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. We're going to be talking about the latest plan about the NSA from the Obama administration, and also Dave Leventhal's report on the Koch brothers' funding of American higher education. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Be back right after this.
This is Your Call here on KALW San Francisco, the weekly media roundtable. This program relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, or you can post your question or comment at yourcallradio.org, where you will also find links related to today's program. Coming up at 11 from the World Service of the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. At noon, the Tavis Smiley Show, and following that, Latino USA, this afternoon at 1, right here on KALW San Francisco.
I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is the Your Call Media Roundtable. We do podcast our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up to find out what's coming up next. On Monday, we're going to be talking about the documentary called Anita, which is about Anita Hill's experience in 1991 when she testified that then Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas had sexually harassed her when she was his employee. We're going to be talking about how we define sexual harassment today, how it's changed, and how Anita Hill changed the conversation around sexual harassment. And on Tuesday, we're going to talk about the complications and risks of transporting oil by rail. It seems like more and more crude oil trains are going to be coming through California, and it's got a lot of local communities and citizens concerned. We're going to be talking about how it works, where it's going, and how safe it is. And if you have a show idea for us, you can always drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org or call 866-798-8255. On our Friday shows, we try to talk about specific pieces of coverage. So if you have an example of something really well done or something you'd like to critique, we welcome your call, 866-798-TALK, or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Our guests staying with us for the rest of the hour are Trevor Timm, co-founder and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, and Dave Leventhal, senior political reporter at the Center for Public Integrity, covering money in politics. Trevor, I want to start talking with you about a big story this week, and that is the latest plan that the Obama administration announced yesterday about changing the way the NSA collects and gets phone metadata. And so it's obviously a response to the Edward Snowden revelations. First, just give me your immediate reaction about what you thought about why this announcement is coming now and how significant it is in terms of the substance.
Well, I think it's significant in a couple ways. One, in a way that could actually be very positive for privacy, but it also could be significant in the fact that it could, in the long run, end up hurting Americans' privacy. There was two proposals announced. One was by the House Intelligence Committee, which is led by Republican Mike Rogers from Michigan, who has been one of the NSA's staunchest defenders throughout the Edward Snowden revelation. And they released a bill which purports to end what they call bulk collection. So right now, you know, the NSA collects virtually every phone call record in the United States. And phone call records is not what you're saying, but who you're calling, who's calling you, for how long you're talking to them, how often, and sometimes from where. And the bill ends bulk collection and says that the phone companies now will hold on to the information. But the problem is the way the law is written, it actually will allow the NSA potentially to search the information that the phone companies have in more situations than they can search for it now. And
so explain that. Explain that.
Well, you know, while the NSA collects all of our phone records now, at least according to the FISA court, they are not supposed to actually search and analyze those call records unless there is a reasonable suspicion that one of your phone numbers is connected to terrorism. And so the NSA claims it's only searched these numbers and mapped out connections a couple hundred times in the past year. Well, what Rogers' bill does is expand that ability to allow the NSA to search phone records at the phone companies if there's something involved in terrorism, but also involved in some what's called an agent of a foreign power, or if you're associated with an agent of a foreign power or connected to. And the term sounds nefarious, but it actually could end up sucking up tens of thousands of innocent Americans, because not only do they search the initial phone number, but they're allowed to do what's called a two hops analysis. So that's, you know, every person that the target is talking to, but then also every person that all of those people are talking to, which ends up being thousands or tens of thousands of people, depending on how many contacts you have in your phone. And this is the general problem with how the NSA does its collection and surveillance right now. But what Mike Rogers is saying, well, we'll just give it to the phone companies, and then we can do more searches. And so, couple that with this other worrying language in the bill that talks about new ways they could collect information from Internet companies, despite the fact that this is supposed to be about ending bulk collection of phone metadata. The bill that Mike Rogers is putting forth is quite worrying in my position.
And I think it's important. I mean, I saw a piece that Mother Jones did that just said five things you need to know about Obama's NSA proposal. And I thought it was great because it just kind of pointed out a couple of things that maybe reading one of the kind of, you know, straight reporting pieces you might miss, or hearing a news headline. The fact that this is just about phone records, it doesn't affect the kind of information, you know, internet-based stuff that I think a lot of people are concerned about related to the Snowden revelations. And that, you know, that Obama could end this program now just by his own action, right? He doesn't have to wait for congressional action.
Right, absolutely. The reason this program exists is because the Obama administration goes to the FISA court every 90 days and asks them to reauthorize it. Well, the reauthorization is actually coming up this week, and Obama could actually just not ask the court to reauthorize it, and then very abruptly the phone collection program will end. So, you know, we were just talking about the House Intelligence Committee proposal. Obama actually has his own proposal. And, you know, to be clear, his proposal looks a lot better than Mike Rogers. First of all, the Obama proposal requires that they go to court before they are ever to search the records at the phone companies, which the Rogers bill doesn't do. But there is definitely some worrying language in the Obama proposal as well. We don't have as much detail because it's not written down, but we do know, like you said, that it doesn't stop any bulk collection for the internet companies or financial records. And there's also the problem that it now looks like, despite what they originally said, the Obama administration also wants to expand the amount of information that the NSA can search for. You know, like I said before it was just terrorism. And in the fact sheet that the White House released just yesterday, they said that the NSA would be able to search this data when they could prove, quote, national security concerns. And I think any decent national security reporter would find that language very troubling because inevitably, virtually every national security reporter could be vacuumed up into this dragnet if the definition of what they could search for is expanded to the ever amorphous phrase national security concern.
I definitely want to bring Dave Leventhal in on this. I mean, Dave, you work as an investigative reporter. You know a lot of people who poke around in places that government agencies might not always like. I mean, when you kind of, the more you've learned about how the NSA works and what kind of information they're collecting, has it changed the way you think about how to do your reporting?
Well, secrecy writ large is an issue for reporters here in Washington, D.C., whether it's dealing with the NSA or many other government agencies. Just from a very practical standpoint, oftentimes it takes reporters much longer than they would like or even what they're used to get access to information that they feel that they should have access to, either through the Freedom of Information Act or just going directly to government agencies and dealing with government officials, doing reporting in the public interest that they feel is essential that they get government records and government documents in order to be able to do their work. So we're talking about slightly different issues here, but under the same general theme of transparency versus secrecy. And it's a story that has been unfolding for years and years and is probably not going to go away anytime soon here in Washington, D.C., and up on Capitol Hill and over at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
And so, and I think that when you talk about, I mean, this the focus, you know, in part of the Obama proposal is, okay, well, let's move from the government having holding this data to moving it back to private companies. And I think that a lot of us go, well, wait a minute. You know, first, what kind of backdoors are still there that might not end up going through the court? But second, you know, how do we want to say, oh, we trust these private entities? And this week, Trevor, you wrote about this case of Microsoft looking into the content of a blogger's Hotmail without any kind of warrant or permission. Could you tell that story and talk about what it might mean for journalists?
Sure. So this actually happened in 2012, but we just found out about it last week because of unsealed court documents. What happened was there was a French blogger who was actually unnamed. We're not sure who he is. But he allegedly received the source code for Windows 8, you know, the operating system that Microsoft produces, from a leaker within Microsoft. Microsoft wasn't sure who this person was and really wanted to root them out so they could prosecute them. And what ended up happening was the French blogger who he gave this information to had a Hotmail account. And so Microsoft decided, without any sort of warrant or court order whatsoever, to unilaterally go into the Hotmail account and root out the leaker. And this has huge implications for news organizations, particularly because there is an increasing news organizations increasingly outsource their email to third parties like Microsoft and Google. The security researcher Ashkan Soltani did a study after this Microsoft blogger situation happened, where he found that 12 out of the top 25 news sites on the internet use either Microsoft or Google for their email. And this means any tech reporter who is potentially reporting on Google or Microsoft and receives a leak that could be damaging to that company's reputation or products potentially could have their email searched without any legal process, because what happens is Microsoft and Google and other companies like Apple and Yahoo all have terms of service, and in the fine print, which you always agree to if you use their products, they can go into your email to read it if it's for what they call, quote, protection of their rights and property. And this is just yet another way that news organizations are losing their legal rights by handing their information to third parties rather than actually hosting their email themselves.
That's Trevor Timm. He is the executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, and you can find that piece that he wrote regarding that blogger whose email was looked into by Microsoft at our website, yourcallradio.org. Also with us is Dave Leventhal, senior political reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. He covers money in politics. Dave, let me ask you, do you know who's hosting the CPI's email?
I believe we have it internally, as a matter of fact.
All right, good. So you're perhaps not directly concerned with this, but a lot of news organizations are. And I definitely want to invite folks to call in if you have questions about the Obama NSA proposal or anything related to these revelations that have come out from Edward Snowden and what they mean both for us as a society and for journalism in particular. The number to call is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Dave, we definitely will take any calls or questions that come in for Trevor, but I want to ask you about this significant investigation that you came out with yesterday, where you went into IRS records to find out what kind of educational institutions and programs the Koch brothers, who I think most people know as major Republican funders, what kind of programs that they're funding at American University. And it's quite extensive. Why don't you talk about some of the most important things you learned in that report?
Certainly, and as you alluded to, they are best known, at least in the public sphere, as for one of two things: either their political participation and the funding and support for a variety of different nonprofit and other types of groups that are incredibly active in the political sphere, and also to their business acumen, which is absolutely incredible. They are two of the richest Americans by large in this country. They are billionaires many times over, and have had incredible success with Koch Industries, their holding company that deals in industries that range from oil refineries to Georgia-Pacific Paper would be another prominent name. But what we found in our research and in investigating this piece that came out yesterday is that during 2012, based on these most recent tax documents that we had made available to us, is that they're funding in part 163 U.S. colleges and universities all across the country. There are 41 states in the District of Columbia that are represented in that group, and all told, it's about $13 million that they put directly into college and university programs across the country. On top of that, they've been funding to the tune of millions more dollars different scholarships and educational programs and organizations that deal with education, again, all across the country. And they're not usually typically giving the money for general purposes or just saying, okay, here's $1 million, go to town, do with it whatever you may. Typically, they're for very specific programs or centers or institutions within universities that focus very much on free market economics and closely align with the Koch brothers' philosophical and economic leanings as it applies to their philosophy in general. This is something that they have been doing for many years, but it is something that in 2012, which was an election year, they did to a very, very strong degree. They are big players in the educational realm. And over the course of talking to about three dozen people, university officials, students, be them what they may, many of them were surprised, particularly the students, to find out that this indeed was the case. There's just simply not a lot of awareness on the campuses that are being funded by Koch-related money, by the private foundations that they control. And it seems to, at the very least, have created a conversation on campuses that weren't occurring prior to this piece coming out.
Dave, rich people, through whatever means, endowing chairs or research centers, this, I mean, that in and of itself is not news. Why would you say, I mean, it's certainly not uncommon, let's say that. How do the Koch brothers stand out?
It's not uncommon at all, and that's a very important point to note, that many of these universities are receiving dozens, if not hundreds, of donations every year from private foundations like the six that we focus on that the Koch brothers control. The difference with the Koch brothers is that most of the people who are involved in educational funding are in no way, shape, or form as politically involved as the Koch brothers, or are bringing to the table the types of, again, philosophical leanings that they have, that they put in practice in a political realm. Question that we get frequently ever since the story went out is, are people saying, well, what about Democrats? Clearly, this is academia here. This is the ultimate bastion of liberalism. You've got to have people who are on the other side, too. The answer is yes. There are perfect examples, George Soros being a prime one, of folks who are quite active in the educational realm. The difference there, though, with Soros and with some others on the left, is that their focus has not been so much domestically in their education-related giving, but overseas. George Soros, for example, operates or founded and funds to a great degree a university in Hungary that he's very intimately involved in. He's funded hundreds and hundreds of scholarships, not for students in the United States, per se, but ones who are supposed to use that money to go back to their home countries and do studies and try to benefit the populations over there. So there's an important difference to be drawn between the Koch brothers and other prominent political donors, both on the left and on the right, in terms of what they're trying to do with the money that they're spending. Not all spending is the same. Not all spending, some would argue, would be equal.
That's Dave Leventhal. He's with the Center for Public Integrity, and he's just published a report called Inside the Koch Brothers Campus Crusade. You can find a link at yourcallradio.org. Also with us is Trevor Tim. He's from the Freedom of the Press Foundation here in San Francisco. And I want to ask you, Dave, I mean, looking at your report, you talk about $13 million that, you know, in this particular year, the Koch Brothers private foundations doled out to universities. About two-thirds of it went to one university, George Mason University in Arlington, Virginia. Why do you think they've made such a point to put so much money into that one institution?
They're funding two centers there. One is called the Mercatus Center. The other is called the Institute of Humane Studies. And both of them are very dedicated to the idea of, as I mentioned before, free market principles and laissez-faire economics, and do a great amount of not only study into those issues, but also some advocacy work. They filed dozens of comments with federal agencies and whatnot. They have numerous types of colloquiums gatherings and whatnot that really serve as a sort of living, breathing organization and institution for putting these ideals and these ideas in action. Charles Koch, in particular, serves on the board of both of those institutions, and it's very controversial over there. You have one school of thought that says, well, all right, fine, they have every right to do this. There are plenty of universities that have institutions or institutes within the university campus that are very leftist. So why not have ones that are talking more about conservative or libertarian thought? But the other school of thought, too, and this was reflected in some of the comments that professors at George Mason University have, they said very simply, well, we're very concerned about the notion of academic freedom here, that if you have these learning centers that are colored by a certain ideology, be it left or right, and then automatically students are going in not for the pursuit of knowledge so much as being, in their words, indoctrinated with a certain way of thinking.
Dave Leventhal, I want to bring Trevor Tim back in, because we've got a couple of folks who've written emails related to Obama's NSA proposal and the surveillance state that we've been learning more and more about. One of them comes from Art in San Francisco. He's says, I haven't heard much talk in the media about the USA Freedom Act or other bills in Congress to rein in the NSA. The USA Freedom Act has bipartisan support and would do more than what the president is proposing in regard to NSA mass surveillance reform. Can you talk a little bit, Trevor, about what the, you know, what the prospects are for some of these pieces of legislation or where they stand? And we also got a very quick email from Nick who said, no collection without a court-ordered warrant is permissible under the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution.
Yeah, well, the USA Freedom Act is really the one bill that is actually taking a hit because of these new proposals. The USA Freedom Act is written by James Sensenbrenner, a Republican from Wisconsin, who was actually the author of the initial Patriot Act, and who was, you know, no one's ever accused him of being a civil libertarian, but he was outraged when he found out about how the NSA had secretly reinterpreted the Patriot Act to collect every single phone call record on every single American. And he's written the USA Freedom Act, which is a much more robust reform bill than either the president's plan or the House Intelligence Committee plan that we discussed earlier in the show. And unfortunately, this bill is being sidelined despite the fact that it does have broad bipartisan support in the House. You know, if this actually went to the House floor right now, there are enough votes already for it to pass. Unfortunately, House leadership doesn't actually agree with this bill and doesn't want it to move forward, so it's kind of stuck in committee right now. And what's going to happen is the House Intelligence Committee is going to try to pound their proposal through very quickly, and so there could potentially be a vote on the House floor within the next week over this bill because they don't want the USA Freedom Act to pass. You know, unfortunately, the USA Freedom Act is really the only comprehensive reform bill that has a significant chance of passing if we can actually get a vote on it. And it's a shame that Congress doesn't push harder for there to be an actual vote, because if they don't, you know, we could end up getting stuck with this House Intelligence Committee bill, and it could make things worse rather than better.
Well, thanks so much for that information, Trevor. And we're going to go and find some resources about the USA Freedom Act and put them on our website, yourcallradio.org. I want to go to the phone lines where William in Belvedere is called in. William, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you very much. One thing that's, that is troubling to me is that I don't find very much evidence of the public who object to, say, the Koch brothers, recognizing that every dollar that the Koch brothers have to give to these causes come out of the pockets of the very people who are buying their products. For instance, I looked it up on the web and found that they own the Brawny Towel Company, the paper towel company, the Sparkle Toilet Paper Company, the Northern Quilted Toilet Paper Company, and Handy Cup. Now, do the guests feel that we could exercise greater control if we were to look at the things that are right in front of us rather than trying to rely on Congress, which is under such corporate control, to make the adjustments that we seek?
That's interesting. Dave Leventhal, I mean, there's been a lot of attention to how kind of Democrats are using the Koch brothers to raise money. They're using them kind of as a boogeyman for the kind of, you know, well-off Republican right. But you know, William's asking, you know, maybe there's more of a kind of a citizen or consumer-based approach to opposing them.
And not speaking specifically about the Koch brothers, but in general about consumerism in this country, the consumer has a lot of power with his or her dollar. And if you educate yourself, if you become aware of the types of companies that produce certain types of products, if you so happen to believe in a certain company, then great, go ahead and buy their products. But also, too, you should, I think it's just some good practice for anyone to educate themselves about the types of corporations or the types of people running corporations who may cut against your personal philosophical feelings on whatever issue it may be. So that's something. There are some good resources out there. A previous organization that I had worked for produced even a book on this that talked about Democrats and Republicans and companies that, based on the donations of their employees, which way they leaned, either right or left. So there are resources out there that that definitely provide tools for consumers to use so that they can make educated choices that would perhaps align with the way that they feel about politics or anything else.
Well, I guess, I mean, the other thing I'd ask is, you know, there's been a lot of reporting around the Koch brothers. They've become these kind of important figures symbolically, in addition to what the actual impact that they have. But this week, there's a lot of reports coming out saying, like, you know, the regular people don't really care about the Koch brothers. It's something that raises money for the Democrats in their, you know, when they're riding their base. But beyond that, it's not really of you know, broad public interest, or certainly not people who are going to go vote, not going to make a difference in swing states or whatever. What do you think?
We wrote a piece back in January called The Democrats' January of Doom, where we tracked all the different fundraising pitches over the past several months that they had put out, and how many times that they were talking about the Koch brothers and the sky falling and just doom and gloom like you've never seen it before. And since there have been numerous pieces, or a great one in the National Journal and the Washington Post recently, about the Koch brothers and how the Democrats are using them, as you said, as the ultimate boogeyman during this 2014 midterm election cycle. But there was also a poll, and this is very compelling, that came out this week that showed that more than half of Americans don't even know who the Koch brothers are, or what they're about, or what they do, or why they should care about them. So there's a bit of a disconnect between the people here inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C., and the folks in middle America. And really, as far as we're concerned, from a journalistic perspective, we're trying to present facts and figures in a very even-handed way to show what's at stake here, who's involved, and where the money is going, and of course, where the money is coming from.
Well, that is going to wrap it up for our media roundtable this week. Dave Leventhal, you were just hearing from, is a senior political reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. You can see his reports about the Koch brothers and more at our website, yourcallradio.org. Also with us for the hour, it's been great to have Trevor Timm with the Freedom of the Press Foundation. And I want to thank you, Trevor, for being with us, and hope we can have you guys both back sometime soon. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening.